Welcome to
the Big Web Show, everything web that matters. I am your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and today's guest, Heather Burns, is a web designer developer originally from Washington, D.C., now a digital law specialist residing in Glasgow, Scotland. She's the author of The Web Designer's Guide to the Consumer Rights Directive, the founder of a monthly e-bulletin with digital law and policy news you need to know. And she says of her consulting, I quote, "While I am not a lawyer, the legislators who create digital laws are not internet users, much less designers or developers. Therein lies the problem. I view my work on digital law and policy as an attempt to build a bridge between the two parties," unquote. So welcome, Heather Burns.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey.
And what time is it in Glasgow?
3:30. Glasgow.
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 Glasgow. Glasgow.
There you go. There you go.
Glasgow. And you said 3:30. But I imagine when you were living in Washington, D.C., you would have said 3:30.
I would have. You're right. That does confuse people.
How long have you been there?
God, 13 years.
Okay. You're Scottish.
Basically. I am now, basically, essentially. Yeah.
Basically.
Excuse me.
Are you an American citizen?
No.
Okay.
It sounds strange, but I really don't consider myself American anymore. You know, this is home. This is where I live and work and have a family. So
how did you pick the place?
Well, my husband's from Glasgow.
There we go. That makes perfect sense.
I got swept off my feet by a Scotsman. You know, these things happen.
Nice.
Yes.
That would probably be a more interesting thing than we're going to talk about, but maybe we'll have time to talk about that too. But you came to my attention. I had the privilege of reading a draft of an article you wrote that is going to be running in A List Apart pretty soon about a kind of a perfect storm of law problems on the internet. Can you explain a little bit what you're talking about when you say a perfect storm of legal problems on the internet?
What I meant by that is that 2015 sort of saw a coming together of all these different problems and issues. And what culminated from that, certainly in Europe, was that some of the basic fundamental building blocks of the web that we use every day, as fundamental as links and shopping carts, came under legislative threat.
Oh, no.
And I thought it was a good time to sit down and take stock of why this is happening and all of these factors that are coming into play here and what the problem is that means that we keep hitting up against these issues over and over and over again.
I became really angry as I read your article, and it reminded me of things that had bothered me, even as simple as you talked about when a couple of years ago, the Affordable Health Care Act came online and the website for it came online, and there were a lot of problems. And basically, this became a political opportunity for the other side to, you know, ridicule what the administration was doing, or, you know, or call into question the administration's competence.
Of course,
which is fine, but it was a perfect example of people who don't use the internet asking absurd questions in voices of indignation. I remember one senator, congressperson, I don't remember what he was, but he said, "Why are there comments in the source code of a produced website? There should not be comments in something that is finished, surely." Like he didn't know what he looked at source code. Someone showed him source code, like looking for something to pick on. And he didn't like the fact that there were comments. It was just like, why is this person talking? Why are all these cameras trained on this person? Why is this person about to make possibly legal decisions or having this conversation that could have legal repercussions when they don't even use the internet, obviously? And I think that's what... Go ahead.
I actually set up a little separate blog to collect all those quotes this year because I kept coming across these quotes from legislators, from politicians. And you're not sure whether to smack your head into the wall or open the window and scream.
You have the URL of that blog?
sanctimoniousclaptrap.wordpress.com. And that came from a quote on the floor of the House of Lords from a politician dismissing informed criticism of his brilliant anti-internet law as, quote, sanctimonious claptrap, unquote.
I see you have one. If you create encryption, it makes it harder for the American government to do its job.
Yes.
Golly. In some ways, when I see legislators talking about the internet, it reminds me of, you wouldn't remember this, but 20 years ago, there was the PMCIAA, it was a parents group that basically they didn't like heavy metal and they didn't like rap music. I guess it was the 90s. And so Tipper Gore was a leader in it, but the Clintons got involved.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
There was, you know, if a kid killed themselves, then it must be because they were backward masking, because there was the accusation that there were suicidal messages that these groups that were just stoned out of their minds, basically.
A lie. Yeah.
Had actually recorded backward messages to make children kill themselves. So just like weird. I mean, and I get concerned parents wanting to, I'm sympathetic to the impulse to try to fix something. It just bothers me when the person doing the proposing the fixing doesn't know what they're talking about. It's kind of like me doing surgery.
Well, you know, 25 years later, the modern equivalent of that is I recently read a story on Al Jazeera English about this anti-radicalization strategy that they've put in to schools in the UK. And apparently most of the schools now have this monitoring software in place that if a student searches for certain keywords, that gets them flagged up as a potential terrorist.
Right.
So if they're doing, you know, perfectly innocent school research on something like ISIS or the caliphate, those words will get them flagged up and a note will be passed to their teacher.
What happens if the student is just doing research on the caliphate for a school assignment? Will the teacher say, oh, they're doing their school assignment, it's fine?
Exactly. Now, that's supposed to be an indicator that needs to be looked at in consideration of other indicators. You know, obviously your teacher will have the good sense to know that you're just a kid doing research. But sort of what bothers me from the digital law perspective is that, you know, on the document my child brings home every August at the beginning of the school year, which is the school internet policy, I don't remember seeing anything about your child's Google searches will be monitored for active suspicion of terrorism.
Yeah, gotcha.
Now, obviously, my child is a white child in Scotland. What if she was like Ahmed Mohammed in the States building his clock?
Right. No, it's intrusive, and I get it, and that is frightening. Let's get back to links.
Mm-hmm.
You said legislation about links. Can you give me an example of, and we could have a whole, we've had this on the show before about civil liberties and terrorism, but I want to keep focused on widely applicable things that could, if acted upon, change the basis of the web, right? That are so that pose a threat to something as simple as links. So can you give me an example of someone trying to legislate linking? I mean, I have one myself, but
this came up in the European Parliament, and it's part of the drive to modernize copyright. Have you read Cory Doctorow's book called Information Doesn't Want to Be Free?
I haven't read that, but I know Cory.
Yes, you need to read that book. It's all about this sort of tug of war in the modernization of copyright law between the fact that we are all creators now, we are all publishers, but copyright law is still very much in the old school
Sure.
of big media conglomerates, big entertainment conglomerates, and they are fighting very hard to double back on copyright law, even as we are all producing and publishing every single day.
I remember when Corey and Lawrence Lessig and some other people at South by Southwest in 2000, seeing them basically introduce Creative Commons. And mm-hmm. the whole point of it was they were worried about, you know, extensions to copyright by the late Sonny Bono, you know, at the behest of finance contributor Disney. So mm-hmm. they're making basically things that were public domain no longer are, and, you know, the absurdities of copyright and the fact that, as you say, if you're, you know, if I want to put some music out there that I want other people to be free to remix, or I want to put a photo out there that I want people to be able to use, or I want them to be able to use it freely in a certain circumstance, but not another, the copyright law that existed wasn't made for that. And that's why they created Creative Commons. Mm-hmm. But what was the issue with links? I'm still not
It all stems into this link, this issue of links and copyright.
Okay.
And
if I link to something, I'm violating its copyright. Is
you
that
could be doing that, but take
which is
that
absurd.
Yeah, that can be a very slippery slope. Very easily lead to, you know, what I saw something in somebody tweeted this week. It was a host somewhere in Europe that got a warning from the Turkish government saying on a site that you are hosting. Yeah, there's links to these articles criticizing the Turkish government put there by a Turk. We disagree. You have to take it down under Turkish law.
Yeah, right.
That's
okay.
The
yeah.
slippery slope we're all getting into here.
I think the big idea in what you're talking about, which we probably should have started with, my apologies, is that the assumption by governments or by multiple governments, like such as in the European Union, that if something's a law in their country or their union, that others, the assumption that you will abide by it. So for instance, we had a discussion a few months ago on a site of mine. Do we need to follow the crude, in Europe, if you use cookies, you have to say we use cookies, and they've gone through several tortuous locutions.
Iterations of that. Yeah.
Yeah. My favorite was, and I tweeted about it a few months ago, it was like, we use cookies. If you do nothing, we'll take that to mean you're okay with this. Like, if I do nothing, does that mean if I don't scratch myself? Does that mean if I do nothing about the cookies? There wasn't a link. It wasn't like they were linking to a page that told you how to disable cookies. They were assuming you had a whole bunch of knowledge about what cookies were and you knew how to manage them in a browser, which was probably a safe assumption in 1995, but isn't a safe assumption among internet consumers now. There was no link, no background, no information at all. And basically this vague, it was just lawyers covering their asses going, yeah, if you do nothing, here's some words that no one will understand, but they get us off the hook and allow us to say, we're intruding on your privacy. We're not going to tell you what these cookies do or how intrusive they are or how much tracking we're going to do across how many websites. But if you don't perform an unspecified action, we're assuming your consent. And I'm like, the law was put there to protect consumers and make them aware of their privacy by being violated. And the lawyers found a perfect way to subvert it, to agree in letter of the law, but not the spirit of the law. So we're using cookies. It's crazy. It's like here's a perfect example of something that's useless, that was designed to help people, and then is implemented in such a way that it does nothing except maybe worry people, frighten people without giving them. And then the reason I bring it up is because, well, we sell tickets for in a better part to people in Europe too. So, and we have a cookie, not an intrusive cookie, but we have a cookie to remember if you've been here before. So do we need to post the European, and my assumption And from everything we could find talking to other Americans was that, no, we, of course we don't have to do that. We are, we're a nation. We have our own laws. We have to obey American laws. We don't have to obey Turkish laws or EU laws or whatever. Everybody has to obey the laws of the land they're in. But I read that, in fact, the EU assumes that everyone will do that. So basically, the EU is saying by...
Well, my friends will be laughing right now who are listening to this because you've chosen to go down the route of my specialist subject.
Okay.
And it's important to remember there's actually not one European cookie law. There are 27 of them.
And I'm supposed to obey them all. And someone in Africa is supposed to obey them all. And someone in China is supposed to obey them all because they're the land of the EU, because they're the law of the EU. Why would a Chinese have to?
That law was, what's the word, devolved to member states. There are some laws, such as the recent consumer rights and e-commerce protection ones, that are the same. So all the member states implement them the same.
Okay.
The cookie law was devolved to each member state to implement as they saw fit. And that job fell to each national data protection authority. So you have 27 different laws ranging from very laissez-faire, which is pretty much the UK's implementation, to the Dutch law was the most rigid one. And that was the one where you were having to tick a box. Yes, I accept this cookie. Yes, I accept that cookie. Yes, I accept this. And that turned into consent fatigue. And then you have the Italian law, which only went into effect this year because Italians don't do anything on time, which is ridiculously strict.
Okay.
So the issue then becomes...
How many checkboxes were there in the Dutch consent fatigue producing implementation?
Well, it depends on any given website.
And when I was checking these boxes, did I know what I was checking? Was it this one allows us to follow you after you leave our website and see what other consumer sites you visit? This one here is, were they that specific?
That's why the law is just the absolute perfect example of a couple of things I wrote about in the article, which is that combination of
coming soon,
which is that combination of, number one, people who don't really understand what it is they're legislating, and number two, laws being glacially slow and taking so many years to come into effect.
Section 508 in the United States is a perfect example. Government websites now have to follow accessibility laws, which I supported in 1999 when they were written.
Right? I just published an article on that this week.
Okay. So, you know,
This
intrigues me. So even though there's area rules and all kinds of modern accessibility, we basically have to, government websites have to act as if
it's 1999.
There are 4.0 browsers, and the main goal of accessibility is, you know, besides putting alt text and ensuring contrast, is to make Flash and PDF content more accessible. It's a completely different environment now.
And this is one of the core problems in digital law, is that we work in an industry that develops at the speed of light and agile. But that is not how government legislation works. When I was doing my university course in digital law, I decided to sort of scratch down to the birth of the cookie law. And it was going down a rabbit hole because you would find this one EU document discussing it, and that would reference an earlier document. So I would have to go to that, and I had to reference an earlier document, and it would have to go to that. So the cookie law, for example, went into effect in 2012 based on a 2009 amendment to a 2003 privacy law. And that 2003 privacy law was born in a 1999 working paper citing cookie data from DoubleClick in 1997.
Wow. When 3 million people were using the web.
Yes. And, you know, your cookie was DoubleClick, pretty much it.
Right.
And this is something we need to work on as an industry. And this is what I've written about. How do we reconcile? Because that is how law and legislation works. I sit on a committee right now, which is a liaison committee to the Scottish Parliament on certain faith matters. And liaising with the government in terms of legislation is a function of writing letters on letterhead. That's how it works. You know?
Wow. You don't write them in Quill. You don't write them in Quill and then have your servant walk them to a typist.
Well, you know, I should be so lucky, but legislation is slow.
This is like when you have, and you've been a web designer, so you know, this is like when you have a client or you have a boss, if you work in-house, who prints out the website on foam core to look at it, never looks at a screen.
Yeah.
And so forget about responsive design, forget about all, you know, basically they're in their mind, there absolutely is a fold, and the fold is whatever happens to be on their laptop. That's the fold.
Now, in Europe, we're gearing up for the revamp of the EU data protection law, which is the law which governs everything online, offline, everything from medical records to personal data to anything you do online. And this is the first overhaul since 1995. Now, you and I both remember what the web was like in 1995. So then the question...
That's insane.
This is what people are very worried about. This law is so huge. And it's going to take years. Now, what one tech advocacy group in the UK has asked for is, can they do this data protection reform agile, block by block, a piece at a time?
Like the way web standards are rolling out now. So there's like this CSS,
I don't think that's going to be possible. It would be logical, but then you risk having one document that different parts of it are under different laws.
So when I think about this, I think of a parallel situation, which is teaching web design at universities. So when people teaching design should be at this point mainly teaching interaction design. Right. But they're not. Mm-hmm. They're still teaching, print design. And of course, universities are supposed to preserve centuries of knowledge. They're not supposed to be on the cutting edge of what's new, because some of what's new is crap. It might go away. And a lot of it's temporal. You wouldn't want to build a whole curriculum around, around a Git. You know what I mean? Or that's actually a bad example. You wouldn't want to build a whole curriculum around a specific framework, which might not be in use a year from
exactly.
now. But so when people have independent schools or graduate schools, or there are training programs that are great at getting people, turning novices into web developers and getting them up to speed instantly, and turning people into web designers and getting them up to speed right away, and sending them out the door with enough skills to learn the rest on the job. But universities are terrible at that, and they're terrible at, and that seems like an unsolvable problem to me. Like, mm-hmm. we're never going to solve that. Universities will always be slow. There would be something wrong if a university were agile. What else are they going to be agile in? Philosophy, right? Art history? What do we hit? We don't want a university to be agile. We want it to be thoughtful and deliberate and conservative and slow. And to me, that's just the way it is. But there, since we work in this lightning speed industry that's changing the whole world very quickly, faster than reason, it's unsolvable. And that's how I feel about what you're describing. I feel like these laws are always going to be out of step and absurd and frighteningly so. And if someone's prosecuted because they do accessibility using modern standards instead of the way it was legally mandated in 1999, that would be a travesty. But I don't think there's any solution. I'm kind of pessimistic about this, and you're not. So I guess that's what I'm going to. To me, I don't see how we can possibly fix this, because by nature, government is collaborative and, you know.
I don't claim to have all the answers, but, you know, the definition of stupidity is repeating the same thing over and over again with the same results.
Right. Insanity also.
That's it. Yeah. So, you know, something has to be done. But what? I don't know. I genuinely don't know how we're going to reconcile these two worlds. Look at VATMOS. I mean, the whole place of supply issue. That came into effect January.
Okay. I don't know what VATMOS is. And I venture to guess that a lot of American and Canadian and other listeners don't know what it is. So can you explain? I know you've advised the adult industry on Vatmos and written eloquently about how unfair it is.
But this a European tax reform that came into effect on the 1st of January. Okay. And it basically changed the way that digital goods and services are taxed in Europe. Basically, it used to be that if someone in France bought my ebook, I would have to charge them UK VAT and just factor that into my business taxes at the end of the tax year. Now, if someone in France buys my ebook, I have to, number one, charge them French VAT, and number two, remit that French VAT to the French tax authority through a continental portal called MOS, hence VATMOS.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Imagine
the countries have to go away. Honestly, the countries have to go away.
Now, where this gets into what we were just talking about was that VATMOS was legislated. The reason we have VATMOS is because you have certain companies, let's not name names, like Amazon and Google, who were headquartering themselves in places like Luxembourg, where the tax rate is only 1.5%. So if I ordered books from Amazon here in Scotland and they were delivered from the distribution center 20 miles down the road, the invoice inside would say the place of dispatch was Luxembourg.
Right.
For tax purposes. So what was happening is companies were channeling billions and billions of pounds of sales through low tax countries. That's not good.
Well,
They put this reform in 2008. Now, think of what digital goods and services were in 2008. It basically meant Amazon eBooks and iTunes.
Right.
But of course, that law then took, 7 years to come into effect?
So it has to do with streaming video, for example, like we have Netflix, Amazon streaming video, stuff like that.
No, it actually doesn't impact streaming video, but it impacts things like plugin sales, theme sales, if you're selling photographs, icons, training programs online, any sort of digital transactions online. It now becomes a taxation matter of mind-blowing complexity. There are something like 80 VAT rates across Europe. You now have to reprogram your shopping cart to accommodate all the possible permutations. I'm not joking, Jeffrey. The implementation guidance actually said what you have to do to determine the location of taxation if somebody bought your ebook on the Eurostar, which is the train between Britain and France that goes underground. If somebody is under the English Channel buying your book on the train's Wi-Fi, how do you determine where to tax it?
See, okay. Now, it's absurd. Everything that you're saying is absurd and horrifying. And I'm
glad.
We're
not done yet, okay, Jeffrey.
Keep going.
The absurd thing was that nobody in the continent ever heard of this law. It was horrendously badly communicated to the accountancy profession. Okay. They didn't know about it.
So it nobody wasn't was communicated. Doing it.
It wasn't communicated by tax authorities. The only reason anybody in the continent of Europe knows about this law is Rachel Andrew.
Wow.
She wrote a blog post. And that was what set this thing off like wildfire.
Because she has Perch, which is a wonderful CMS. And so if there's shopping in a Perch CMS, I imagine she's brilliant and looks at everything in detail. She probably went, oh, well, I'll obviously have to make Perch comply, or our partners who make the shopping cart component will have to comply. And nobody else even knew about it.
It was more of looking at the document and going, hold on. Uh-oh. No, 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 no. Because she instantly recognized what this really meant. And she wrote that blog post last autumn. It's probably going on a year just now. That is why the whole continent knows about this law now.
Just to be fair, hang on for a second. How is this different from, I live in the United States, and if I buy something from Apple.com and I live in New York, it has to add New York tax at the end. And if I live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, it has to add Pennsylvania tax at the end. So it's the same product, but I mean, isn't this the same as that? It's not, you know, it's never been, well, Apple's in California, so I should pay California tax every time I buy a product from Apple. It's, you know,
the problem is that Apple has enough money to hire a small army of finance and accountancy people.
Right.
Your obligations to VATMOS in Europe start from the first penny of the first sale. So you are then plunged into this massively complex and bureaucratic continent-wide taxation system, regardless of your sales. You know, the marginal cost is the same.
It sounds like an opportunity for a shopping cart manufacturer to take all that complexity and solve it for us, right? So is anyone doing that?
Well, they've done their best. They've had to write, you know, extensions to existing shopping carts, you know, calculating these 80 different European VAT rates. But okay. That's just the shopping cart. You've still got to do the taxation bit yourself. As a business owner.
Sure.
But, you know, you've still got to do all that paperwork.
Because I live in the United States, we sell books from a book apart, and our accountant make sure that we comply with the state laws. And if we ship from Nevada, then we have to pay Nevada taxes. And this is why accountancy is a job that will never go away in America. I mean, I guess we're used to this. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how it's different, is what I'm saying, or how it's more egregious than that.
Do you have a minimum sales level in some states? I genuinely don't remember. Past which certain taxes are due? Or is there like a threshold?
I don't think so.
What's happening is we've had people in Europe getting, and this is not supposed to happen, they're being chased up by tax authorities in other countries over discrepancies of less than, I am not joking, less than 5 euros. In one case, 5p.
That I have not heard of. My business is proactively. So I have a very smart accountant. And at one time, when we did an Event Apart show in Texas, in Austin, and we did an Event Apart show in California, basically everyone who worked at the company or everyone who was a founder of the company had to pay personal taxes to those states as if we lived there, in addition to the taxes we pay to the places where we actually live. And we began limiting the places that we would do the show based on how many sets of taxes we were going to have to pay. And we're a small company, just two founders, three consulting staff. We keep a bookkeeper and an accountant very busy with that kind of stuff. And I get, you know, at my home address, I'll get, you know, the state of Nevada telling me I need to publish some nonsense. You have to comply with the state laws if you do business.
People affected were going to their accountants with this paperwork.
Right.
Saying, you know, the Netherlands wants £5 off me. And the response of the accountants was, is this a windup? There were accountants who didn't believe this law was real. So you have really good accountants. This law was barely communicated to the accountancy industry.
Well, so, I don't know. I have a good accountant. She said all the states are going to be doing this soon. And so she basically prepared us for it. And she's very mm-hmm. good. Lisa Balsamo is my accountant. She's very good. She's very good. But basically she said, you know, the states.
What's basically happened is that what you might call coffee table businesses, just self-employed people selling plugins or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. They are being brought into corporate levels of bureaucracy and regulation. And they're completely on their own. You know, these are people who don't even have accountants.
Who speaks for them?
Nobody. There is a campaign group that started up around Christmas last year called the EU VAT Action Campaign, which is, again, just affected small micro businesses, coffee table businesses. And they have, I don't know how they've done this because it's astonishing. Within this year, they have achieved consultative status with the European Union. And they are flying out to Brussels and to all these EU summits to discuss all these problems. But in order to do that, to fly out from Brussels, they're having to crowdfund.
What?
Sure, having because, to, yeah.
because they don't serve a large corporate master that can afford to take care of this.
Exactly. And of course, the time that, you know, self-employed people are flying out to Brussels to negotiate with finance ministers is time they're not spending on their own businesses.
Right. Yep. Again, do you, the first step in fixing things like this is to create awareness, which your article will do, which the articles you write, you've been writing at Web DevLaw do, and which hopefully conversations like this do. Can you imagine, can you see it happening that VAT law just goes back to what it was? You know,
well,
I'm in
the EU VAT action campaign has been very clear on what needs to happen.
Yeah, what is that? What would simplify it?
First thing that would simplify it would be a threshold, which is, you know, a basic level of sales income before which you don't fall into this tax system, because, you know, even tax lawyers are saying the admin and processing costs are not, right. You're not even making them up.
Right. If I earn 25 euros and it takes you $5,000 to find me and prosecute me for the half a euro that I would owe you in taxes, what benefit was that to you?
I mean, Cory Doctorow tweeted how much money he had to spend reconfiguring his shopping cart. It was a lot of money to find out he owed two figures.
But he's in the United States. Why would he have to reconfigure his shopping cart?
Because the tax law, you don't have to be in Europe.
I'm sorry.
Okay, if you're in America and you buy a book off a German author, am I getting this confused here?
Yeah, I sell books. We sell books, a book apart, to Tal and Jason, and we sell in Europe. We deliver in Europe.
You're still liable for these various national taxes. In fact, you always have been.
Right.
Are you turning bright red right now, Jeffrey?
No, I think we know this and comply with it. But this is why I try to put myself in a remote managerial position. So I can go, wow, we really need some smart people to take care of this for us. But you know what I'm saying? I don't know the details. I know that we use Shopify, and I know that Shopify is very smart and very compliant. And we've been selling overseas for years.
So technically, if somebody in Germany buys the List Apart series, the Book Apart series,
Yeah, they pay German, we charge the German tax, and we pay for overseas shipping.
But are you remitting that German tax back to Germany?
Yeah. Well, okay. We don't keep it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is where a lot of,
like I said, I have a good, we have good accountants. So I think, I think what we're saying is, now ask me if we make a profit. We don't make much of a profit. The authors do okay. The people who work for us do okay. We charge as little as possible for our books, but you know,
now, this is getting into the other problem. It's that I guarantee you somebody out there is listening right now and going, the what?
Yeah, sure.
How is an e-commerce business in America supposed to know this? You know, how are we supposed to get on in an industry where we get our legal advice off Twitter?
Well,
things we just happen to spot.
Sure. Well, because there's no even, like, design has AIGA. Traditional design, we don't have that. We don't have an advocacy group or a representative group, trade association.
I got some snippy accountant having a go at me, and then she blocked me, calling me lazy and unprofessional because I'd never heard of VATMOS before Rachel Andrew. Well, she's been a member of several guilds since university who send her email briefings twice a month.
Right.
You know, professional guilds and industry bodies, they do that sort of legal advising, advocacy, and communications work for you. And that's how you find out about whatever.
But we're a self-taught agency.
We are.
I read Rachel Andrews' blog. I read A List Apart and Smashing Magazine. and I bought this book and I go to this conference. That's how we do it. That's how we evolve.
There was a summit of finance ministers last month in Dublin trying to get to grips and find a solution for all these VAT-MOS problems. And what one of them got up and said was that from now on, we're going to work harder with industry bodies. And a lot of us were sitting at our computers going, no, 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 no. That's the mistake they made in the first place. They're communicating. They still live in a world where communications are vertical.
Yeah.
You know, I call it the man in a suit syndrome. A man in a suit with authority conveys information below and it goes down in a triangle. Our industry is lateral.
From the office of the vice president.
Yeah. We are horizontal.
Yep.
That's how information flows into us. So if they're going to focus...
That's the beauty of it.
Yes, but if they're going to focus on working with industry bodies, how does that help us?
Doesn't. And we're gonna pause on that painful question. And I am going to, speaking of money and collecting taxes and all that good stuff, I am now going to give our sponsors, I'm going to pay the rent and give our sponsors message. By the way, I believe that just by my giving the sponsors message, I will probably owe Luxembourg some taxes, but I'm not going to do anything about that. So come and get me, Luxembourg. Braintree. This episode of The Big Web Show is brought to you by Braintree. Code for easy online payments. Oh boy, is this the right day for these folks to sponsor us. Code for easy online payments. If you're building a mobile app and searching for a simple payment solution, check out Braintree. The Braintree V.0 SDK makes it easy to offer multiple mobile payment types. Start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo, cards, and more, all with a single integration. You get quick, knowledgeable developer support if you have questions. And you can accept all these cards that I just mentioned and whatever's next, just with one integration. One small snippet of code and you're all set up in less than 10 minutes. So to learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to braintreepayments.com/bigwebshow. Now, some additional things you should know about this is that it takes minutes to integrate this in Braintree. And if you don't have time, give them a call and they'll either walk you through it or do the integration for you. Braintree's code supports Android, iOS, and JavaScript clients. In other words, everything. And has SDKs in 7 languages, .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, and Ruby. It's elegant code with clear documentation, and it's just 10 lines of in-app code. Pretty sweet. So, again, to learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions with no fee, go to braintreepayments.com/bigwebshow. That's braintreepayments.com/bigwebshow. And that is the sponsor's message. And I wonder if the product will be changing at all in response to what we're discussing today, or if they already, these folks already know about and are in compliance with what we've been talking about. You recently saw a cousin whom you hadn't seen in 30 years and you saw her on a video and said, oh, she's got the family cheekbones, which is one of the best lines I've ever seen. Did you want to talk about that at all?
You know, you see that picture and it's like, cousin, I know that face.
This who is this?
I'm not going to say because, you know, it is
no names,
daylight, but it is daylight hours, but this was in the context of the post I wrote yesterday, just helping some adult industry professionals with their VAT-MOS issues because, hey, a 2008 law on e-commerce didn't factor in adult work online.
How could they not? It's always been the biggest, it's always at the forefront of every change on the internet. And everything else.
I have a hell of a lot of time for adult industry professionals because I've done a little bit of work with them in the past and I have honestly had more intelligent business conversations with them than I have had with some managing directors.
When you say professionals, you're talking about like cam girls?
Yes. Yes, this now this is all legal, consensual, safe adult right. work. This is not anything that should not be on there. But the right. other no. reason I have a lot of sympathy for them was, as you said, I opened up a paper reading a tabloid scandal and saw a cousin I hadn't seen in 30 years. And she got screwed over in every sense of the phrase by a celebrity, and she screwed him right back. And I was cheering her on from over here. You know, you go, girl. Take him for what he's worth. Anyway, yeah, they were being charged the wrong VAT on this adult website because, and you can't even blame the platform for that because they don't understand this law any more than we do.
The porn industry charges VAT, or the adult industry charges VAT?
The adult industry was charging incorrect VAT moss to both the performers on the website and their customers.
The performer pays a tax?
They were making the performer pay VAT moss on the admin fees they pay for the use of the site. Do you know what Rainmaker is? The Rainmaker platform? Okay.
No, it's a
platform. Just imagine an adult Rainmaker and you get the idea of what kind of site we're talking about.
Is it like I can set up a cam and broadcast? Is it kind of like video?
Yes.
Video broadcasting?
Video hosting, whatnot.
Okay.
It's a platform that takes care of that for you. And the platform
was... Wait a minute,
do
I pay taxes to the country that hosts the platform? Or do I have to pay different taxes to depending on who's watching me?
They were actually having to work out, you know, if I think the site was based in Greece or Malta or someplace like that. Let's just say it was okay. Malta. And, you know, a German man decides to watch an Irish girl.
I think I saw that movie.
It is only 4 in the afternoon here, Jeffrey. Come on.
It's 11 here.
So they were actually making the customers who use the site to watch the entertainment upload the two pieces of data that the VAT moss rules require to correlate your location so they can charge you the right taxes.
I'm sorry, but isn't anonymity the whole point of all that stuff anyway? I mean...
Yeah, I mean, you don't really want to be uploading your bank statement to prove your address to an adult entertainment site.
I can't even imagine anyone doing that.
But the point was they shouldn't be charging VAT moss on this at all because... And this is when... I'm sorry if this conversation is a bit... not what you would expect for some people, but these are girls basically doing live sex shows. And we're having to look in a tax table in a textbook to see where does a live sex show fall on this table.
At the same time?
Sorry. You tell me, Jeffrey.
This reminds me, years ago at Happy Hog, we were applying to become, to do a design job for a government agency, a U.S. government agency. And we had to look up, in order to apply, we had to fill out a whole bunch of paper. This is common still in the United
yes.
States. A whole bunch of paperwork about yourself and whether there are veterans in your board of directors and all this and where, how many millions of, you could be two freelancers. You still have to do all this stuff. And so we were doing it all. And then we had to list what kind of company we were. And I actually spent a fair amount of money asking lawyers, like hiring different lawyers to try to figure out because there was no such category as digital designer or web designer or, I mean, there was nothing because this was probably a 20-year-old thing. It was like, we make farm implements. We sell tractors. I mean, it was all stuff like that. It was like, and I think we ended up having to say, like the closest thing that we could say was that we made a newspaper for farmers or something. It was like a crazy out of another century.
I've written a post about that is that part of the reason we keep hitting our heads against a wall with these digital laws is that certainly in the UK, the sort of national statistical taxonomy of business activity is only updated once a generation.
Yeah.
So A think tank did a story on this, a research study on this last year, and they calculated there's something like 300,000 digital businesses in the UK, which literally do not count.
Exist in the taxonomy. Yep.
Definition has never been updated. Just getting back to our girls, if you're wondering what cam girls do when they're not doing their shows, they're on the phone to HMRC, which is the tax authority here, asking paid professionals, does my live sex show qualify under European VAT rules? And the answer is no, it doesn't. So I've helped the girls confirm that their platform should not be charging their customers the national VAT.
Are they able to take that off the platform?
They're going to try to get refunds because everybody needs refunds now because, you know, the platform's been charging them VAT on the admin fee they pay for the use of the site, and they've been charging VAT.
I'm seeing divorces. I'm seeing Mr. McGregor. We've got your refund from the cam girl as he's sitting there at breakfast with his wife. I'm sorry. I'm not helping anything.
So that's been my good turn for the week.
That is great. I'm glad to hear something happy because as I was reading, again, your article, which will be coming out soon, I was getting so angry thinking of all these absurdities. Mm-hmm. My whole career. It's just, I mean, at first it was cool going, this is so underground. Nobody knows what I do. I'm a web designer. Yeah. But now it's just like, this is absurd. This is 2015. And we're still, like you said, dealing with overhauling 1995 laws, about to overhaul a 1995 law. Mm-hmm. In ways that will. Yeah. So, I had another great example of this absurdity, which just slipped my mind, but it'll come back. But so aside from getting angry and from taking on specific details, like, I mean, what do we do? You work with the Scottish government as a liaison between internet and government. So
I'm wrong. Yes, you're wrong on that. It's a faith-based committee working on matters like, welfare reform.
Okay.
But the point is, to make our voice heard, we have to sit on that committee and we have to work with others.
Yeah. This is like when designers had to get serious and work with the W3C. We couldn't just ignore it and do what we wanted to do because the industry was just going to fragment. And we couldn't go, oh, this is boring. And we have to get on. And with the W3C, we have to get on newsletters. They're still in 1993. The W3C is like super advanced in what they envisioned for us, but they communicate on private mailing lists, on listservs from the early 90s. And you have to do that. You can't, there's no, they don't even use the web.
I think part of the answer hit me when I was walking around Glasgow one day, and I always pass this building, and it's called the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons. And it's a big old grand building. It's like, it's got a library and a private members club and a private restaurant and a museum featuring some absolutely terrifying surgical implements from history. And the reason that organization was started was because physicians and surgeons realizing they needed to come together.
Yes.
And unify as a profession and speak up as a profession.
Like the Art Directors Club.
Yes.
The original Art Directors Club in New York is around the corner from where I live. It was designed by Stanford White, and I'm always blown away by that building and taking pictures of it. They're not there anymore. They're on the in a different neighborhood now, and there's art directors clubs all over the country. But it started with that, and it is the same thing. Like, nobody knows what we do, and our clients won't take us seriously, and we won't be able to charge fair fees for our work, and we won't be able to have ethical standards unless we get together and form a group. So you
now
have
that building.
I have the art directors club. Yes,
that they've not always been in that building. But do you know when that organization was founded?
1700s?
Earlier than that.
Wow.
1588.
I love going to Europe. I love to Europe because
this is an organization that got it.
Yes.
500 years ago.
I just have to say, brackets as an American. Like, I'm in Sweden in a church where they have the ancestral kings of Sweden in this buried in the floor. Like, so you sit there trying to talk to God, and right under you is the skeleton of the first king of Sweden. Or you go to Rome, of course, and go to the Vatican, and just, you know, the, it goes back to Peter. It's like amazing. I love that about Europe. And I, you know, I just wanted to get that plug in for how much I love Europe in spite of its VAT moss.
You feel better now.
I do. I know. VAT moss so bad. Ancient church good.
Fast forward to this year, and I was watching a debate, a political debate on BBC Parliament, which is like C-SPAN. Mm-hmm. And this was about a draft surveillance bill, internet surveillance bill, that they were basically trying to push through in what was almost an abuse of parliamentary procedure so that our paranoid right-wing Home Secretary could get her way. And there was a member of the House who stood up to have her say on this bill. And what she said was that politically, she supported it. Ideologically, she supported it. But on principle, she had to oppose and vote no on the bill because of the abuse of parliamentary procedure in trying to push it through. And the thing that really made her angry, and she was gobsmacked by this, is that in trying to push through this bill on internet surveillance, they had not consulted the industry body with professional standing, which in this case was the Internet Service Providers Association. And because they hadn't consulted with the industry body, she had to turn down the law on principle. And I'm sitting there going, that's it. That's how you do it. Simple as that.
Wow.
So
explain more. Explain more. That's how you do it. What? Translate that into a couple of specific actions so I'm sure I understand what you mean by that. So I love the story, but so I want to know what you mean.
Essentially, what was happening is there was a law concerning the fundamentals of internet use. And there is an industry body, which is all the big ISPs, you know, TalkTalk, Virgin, BT.
Who I don't necessarily trust.
You wouldn't know, but they fight like cats and dogs for your business, but they're smart enough to work together, you know, in
sure.
as like, an industry.
Sure.
And
like the movie industry, the cable industry, yeah. Sure.
And they have consultative status, which means that they are recognized as the official voice of the industry. And if the government wants to regulate something concerning their industry, they are morally obliged to run that draft law by them.
So web design needs consultative status? Web design and development?
We need something, Jeffrey, because that's how the game is played. Whether we like it or not, them's the rules.
So we need an organization, you think?
We need something. We need to start playing the game on their level. My undergraduate degree was in international politics, and we spent a lot of time on game theory. Don't know if you know what that is, just
sure.
working through, you know, politics is a series of chess moves. And the people who participate in these games are called actors. All the fundamentals of political game theory assume that all the actors show up.
Mm.
There is no game theory scenario for a government legislating on an industry that the industry doesn't show up.
When the actors don't show up, but here that's the case.
Exactly.
Well, how about the WHAT working group and the W3C for starters? Not as the be-all and end-all, but just shouldn't a government that's making internet laws automatically consult with them? Shouldn't they consult with browser makers? Automatically.
I think the closest thing we have to an organized industry body is the accessibility community.
Right.
That's just been my personal observation.
But that's organized the way Alcoholics Anonymous is organized. It's not organized at all. It's just there's a passion and commitment in all these dispersed ad hoc groups, and there's a willingness to work together. Unless I'm missing something.
I mean,
I see those as very individual people. All
obviously,
these people
with
accessibility are very, very individualistic and passionate. And I don't see that as a hierarchical thing at all.
when you're talking about things like, you know, data retention for surveillance purposes, obviously that would fall to the remit of the ISPs, because it's going to be their job to siphon up all this information. What we're dealing with now is laws affecting UX. And to go back with cookies, you know, we spent 15 years getting people to stop using pop-up windows for accessibility purposes.
They're still using them here. They just call them something else.
And then the EU comes in and some of the member states say your cookie compliance thing could be a pop-up. So how do we, you know, when laws are being implemented that the end result affects UX and code, how do we have our say on that? Because you need to be organized, number one. Number two, you need to have consultative status. Now, with all due respect to everyone's PHP user group, that's not going to get you consultative status.
Yep.
I don't claim to know all the answers here.
Yeah. I think of all the misfits I know in this business and how I wouldn't want any of them forming another group.
Well, that's why you don't, but that's why people have lobbyists, you know, political professionals who know the game.
But they would have to know the internet as well. And they would have to know the internet, not just my kids on YouTube, but they would have to know the internet as developers and designers and UX people. They would have to really know it.
Or they need to surround themselves with people who do and can give them the proper briefings and can explain to them in a way they can understand why you can't have, you know, we saw the suggestion this year that a VATMOS workaround, if you don't want to go into the VATMOS system, just shut off your shopping cart and return to something like emailing to make an order. And now, whoever made that suggestion, number one, probably hasn't bought anything online since 1995. But number two, obviously has never heard of the cart abandonment rate.
Okay, that's how my kids' school website is run. But I mean, it's a public school, it's tax funded, and I get it. But like, they took down. So one of the things that used to be on the school website was the email address and phone number for everyone who taught or worked at the school, which seemed like a good idea because kids sick or you don't understand why they got a certain grade and you want to talk to a teacher. They took that down. They kept a link to it. The link just kept, they took the link out of the navigation. So you had to like hack your way, basically trying a bunch of URLs. I finally found the page that linked to the list directory listing, which when you clicked on it, linked to itself. There was nothing there. It was just, so I let them know that there was a problem with the website and asked if they needed help or whatever. And they said, no, we did this deliberately. We're not going to list the people because, you know, a lot of the teachers don't really use email. And if you have a question for the teacher, you should just put it on an index card and have your child bring it in their school bag, their overflowing school bag that weighs like 50 pounds where they lug all these hardcover books back and forth every day. And, you know, I'm just like, I don't understand. How is that an option that the teachers don't use email? I'm not saying you should email them in the middle of the day and expect an answer, but how is that okay that the school doesn't provide email? I mean, should we go back to smoke signals? I'm sorry. I have like a lot of problems with this stuff and you keep on, wow. I'm going to need like a long walk or a cold shower or something after this. Cause you're hitting all my hot buttons. I'm really like, I'm usually a very calm.
You're not watching that video we talked about earlier, are you?
Not hot buttons that way. No, I'm anger. This stuff really makes me mad, you know?
So
and I get up at it's cool, but it's just the absurdity of you don't have to use the internet. I get that, but don't.
And this is why I've called it a perfect storm.
Right.
Is that we have all these factors coming together, Jeffrey, about laws that take years to go into effect. We don't have a voice to speak out. And we've got people who, you know, as I wrote in that article, are actually proud of the fact that they don't understand what they're legislating, making laws that impact a code and UX level.
Right. No, sir, I'm a professor. I don't use the internet.
It's that's what it is like sometimes. It really and truly is.
If Geoffrey Chaucer would have wanted an internet, he would have mentioned it in his Canterbury Tales. It's very weird. Very weird. It reminds me of something Ted Turner said years ago. There was a period where Turner wanted people to watch old movies, great classical movies, but he did some research and found that one reason young people weren't watching black and white movies, they'd grown up with color TVs and they couldn't relate to black and white at all. It just depressed them. They weren't interested. It made it seem old. So he and his employees created this colorization software where they went into the computer and they would give Humphrey Bogart kind of orangey skin and make his trench coat look sort of a urine yellow color. And just, it was awful. I mean, it was great for the time. It was the 80s. It was amazing technological achievement, but misguided. The idea that Citizen Kane would be better in color or, you know, that a classic Hitchcock film of the 1940s would be better in color. It's absurd.
There's an advert over here that freaks me out every time I see it, and it's for Galaxy Chocolate, which is just really mediocre milk chocolate. But with the permission of her family, they actually did a CGI resurrection of Audrey Hepburn.
Oh, my God.
At her youngest and sort of most fresh-faced, most beautiful. So she's the CGI Audrey who, you know, my daughter didn't understand that she'd been dead for 20 years.
Right.
You know, gets off a bus, eats some chocolate, and goes off on an adventure.
I think I read about that, and I've seen one where Fred Astaire danced with a vacuum cleaner. They took Royal Wedding, I believe, a Technicolor extravaganza with Fred Astaire, and digitally substituted an Electrolux for the broom that he was dancing with. I don't know how they were able to do that. I don't know how his but I just wanted to finish the Turner story. That when Turner started taking heat for doing colorization, he said, well, if the directors didn't want that in the picture, they should have put that in their contracts. That if Orson Welles had not wanted people in the 1980s who had computers to colorize his film, he should have put that in his employment contract with Columbia, MGM, I don't remember who it was, when he made the film.
Derivative copyright. I'm just hearing one of my professors yapping about this in my head. You know, derivative copyright, making a second similar copywritten work based on a previous one.
So
good derivative copyright story for you. When Amazon first introduced text-to-speech capability in Kindles, that it would just read the book out loud for you automatically.
Yes.
This was a brilliant accessibility thing because right there you have an accessible book reader.
So who tried to shut it down? A copyright lawyer?
Yes, because depending on whose nation's copyright law you believe, they took the position that when you're setting your Kindle to read a book out loud, that's creating a second separate copy of the work.
Yep.
And as a result of this suit, Amazon
No one's getting paid for that. And the author isn't getting paid for the computer.
And, now, as a result of this suit, Amazon had to ship a firmware update that deleted the text-to-speech off the Kindles. So imagine you're blind halfway through a book and it just stops. So the response to that was that in the UK, at least now,
it's a tragedy.
You are allowed to make a copy in a text-to-speech version or in any sort of accessibility version for one-off use, and it is not a copyright violation.
Well, thank goodness for that.
Absolutely.
That's horrible.
It is.
And it's absurd.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so let's say that you had a certain copyright in the 1950s, and you're still alive. Wow, that's awesome. But you're still alive. Congratulations. But now something's being done digitally and you're not getting paid. Maybe you should be getting paid. I get that point of view too.
Mm-hmm.
Right, right. There were a lot of, in the 90s, there was a lot of problems where magazines were putting their content online, but they hadn't negotiated online use as another use for the author's article, and the author would say, well, you're getting a million extra readers, so I should be compensated. I didn't negotiate this. I negotiated, you know, it was work for hire or whatever. You paid me for the copyright for this print edition that had X number of thousand. Anyway, I have a couple of really wonderful lawyers in my life. So I'm not against the legal profession. The right lawyer is golden, and they're like a good lawyer is like a good rabbi. But
I think it's important to say that, you know, anyone listening to our conversation might think we're having a go at governments for their own sake or having a go at laws. That's not the case. There have been some excellent digital laws. There are some excellent politicians.
I just want to point out one that was bad.
Okay.
And this is before. So you may know this story. When Steve Jobs and Woz created Apple, the Beatles management company was called Apple Corp. This isn't a copyright, right? Apple Corp. And they sued and said, you can't use the name Apple. That's our name. And legally, they said, well, we're a computer company and you're a music company, so there's no infringement on your trademark. And then the Beatles lawyer said, okay, but if you ever make sound, it will be infringement because sound is music. And they had to accept that. And then when they introduced in, I don't know, System 7 maybe, the beep, the system beep, the Beatles company, not the Beatles. I'm sure Paul McCartney didn't know anything about it, but the Beatles company sued Apple successfully because there was now, they argued in court, every possibility that a consumer could confuse the beep that an Apple computer made for the music of the Beatles. That Apple was now making sound and was now in the music business. I mean, 30 years later, Apple is in the music business, but not at the time, right? And in fact, that's the reason that the name of the original beep on the Apple computer is Sosumi. Because they knew that having a beep would be really helpful to a lot of people, not just people with limited vision, but to a lot of people. Having audio feedback was a good user affordance. It was a good thing to do. It was good design. But they knew that the Beatles lawyers would come after them because now Apple made a sound, and sound and music are so similar the consumer might be confused. And that's an example to me of technically that might sound good on paper, but obviously that's an abuse to me. Obviously that's an abuse to say that consumers would get confused by the beep your computer makes.
I'm sure all of the laws we've discussed today looked great on paper.
Yeah. And we should say, always, it's almost, not always, sometimes someone's doing something nefarious at the behest of a campaign donor, like Sonny Bono, the late Sonny Bono did when he extended copyright law to please Disney after they'd helped him win re-election. But often, these are people who, like the PCM, CIA, whatever, the parents, the people, Tipper Gore's organization, they didn't want kids, you know, being exposed to negative, inappropriate stuff that might make them think it was cool to take drugs or commit crimes or whatever. Totally get that. You want to protect children. That's a good impulse. But the implementation, maybe not so good. And I think we're talking about how do we – governments aren't going to abandon their mandate to make laws and regulate things, nor should they. You're talking about how do we help them make better laws. And your thesis is that we need a seat at the table. We have to figure out how to get a seat at the table, because if we don't have a consultative status where the laws will just keep being bad and impossible to implement, impossible to obey or even know about, and so on.
We're stuck in this dreadfully passive-aggressive loop, Jeffrey, of these laws come out and we rant against them. And we rant against the policymakers who have created them. But we don't do anything about it. We don't learn our lesson.
Everyone complains about the weather.
Yes. Do something about it.
Yes. This has been the first of what I hope will be several conversations with Heather Burns. Heather Burns is a digital law specialist in Glasgow, Scotland.
Woohoo! You got it.
Glasgow. She's done extensive writing on the EU cookie law, the EU consumer rights directive, and the EU place of supply reforms. You can find Heather at webdevlaw.uk, sanctimoniousclaptrap.wordpress.com, ideal15word.wordpress.com.
Idea, IDEA. That was my original web design business, and I'm actually terrified to change the URL and lose my Google juice. So.
Yeah, don't do that.
I don't.
We will put all the URLs on the website when this. What's going to happen next, of course, as always, is that 5x5 will come in, smooth the audio, add the mysterious hip hop track to the beginning, and this will then become a numbered show in iTunes. But for now. Thanks, listeners. Thanks, sponsor. And thanks, Heather.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
See you at another Big Web Show soon.
Bye.